Hello and welcome to the Private Practice Made Perfect podcast. I'm Kathy Love. I started life as an OT, had an amazing, crazy private practice which I sold. And what I do now is help allied health business owners create a business that serves them, the time, the money, the joy that they absolutely deserve. And this is where my idea for the podcast started. What I want to do is to capture how hard allied health business owners in Australia work to achieve their dreams, to support their teams, to create amazing outcomes for their clients. So sit back, beverage of choice, drive safely, walk carefully, however you're listening in, and I hope you absolutely enjoy. Hello and welcome to the podcast, Ed Johnson. Good to see you.
Good to see you too, Kathy. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. We've done a quick calculation that it's 4 or 5 years since we saw each other, so we're on the catch-up as well.
Too long, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think we're in Melbourne for a bit of a catch-up one time. Ed is a speech pathologist by training and has done a lot of extra post-grad work, but his current role at the moment is with Sarah on the board and in the executive crew. How about you kind of just explain a little bit about your allied health profession life first, and then I really want to get into the good stuff about Sarah.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a speech pathologist and have been a speech pathologist for going on about 12 years now. And I sort of fell into speech pathology because I studied anthropology and linguistics and loved doing that in an arts degree, but it didn't sort of get me a professional role as such. So I decided to do a master's in speech and sort of here we are. From the first job I had, or from the first time I studied, really, all I wanted to do was work in a rural area. I grew up in the Blue Mountains, which is sort of, you know, in between city and country.
Bit of both.
Yeah. And a lot of the time when you live in the mountains, you either sort of move to Sydney or you move out west when you finish school or finish uni. So I decided to move out west, and I had a lot of family in the central west in the past, so I sort of had a bit of a family connection there and played a lot of sport out there when I was younger. So I moved out there and sort of started going further and further west as my career progressed, and really loved it. But very early on in my career, I found that the services that we were offering just weren't enough. There wasn't enough allied health, and there wasn't enough time that we could spend with families to give them what they really needed. And a lot of the time it depended on someone's postcode, whether or not they would get the support they needed. And I just didn't feel like that was good enough, you know, and I felt like when we were seeing people, it was more the choice of the clinician about what we're actually working on, or, you know, which person got seen. And I just didn't think that was fair. So that sent me down the road of researching what do families really want in the bush. And so I did a PhD and looking at what they want, and trying to figure out how we can help people to live their best life through, you know, through providing allied health supports.
And where they live.
Exactly. I don't want people to have to move house, to move home, to move to a different city, to move to to move away from where they live and where they love, just because there's no services there. And we know that's happening all the time. We see it in the literature even, and we know people just can't deal with the lack of services, so they just pull up stumps and head off to the city, and I don't think that's the best way for people to be able to live their best life and to stay with their family and friends in the communities that they love and that they've grown up in.
And want to stay in, ultimately.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was blown away with the statistic you sent through about the percentage of Australians living rural and remote. 28% of Australians live rural and remote, about 7 million people. Mind blown. And I said before I hit record, I thought it would have been 10 or 15. So my sheer metro ignorance, shouting loud.
Yeah, it was much larger sort of in the 50s, 60s.
Yeah, 70s. Would have been.
I think it was something like 60% back when my parents were growing up. And everyone had cousins or family or grandparents, whoever, in the bush, and they knew about, you know, what it meant to be in primary production, what it meant to live in a small town, the realities of living in rural and remote Australia. And I think that brought a lot more awareness to people living in metro areas. And this is sort of coming from my parents and stories my parents have told me, sort of dad growing up in the bush. And I think we've lost a lot of that these days. We have a disconnect between city and country. And we I saw this recently. I went to the NDIS Job Summit in Canberra, and we're talking about how do we get the NDIS fixed so that it's, you know, we're employing more people with disabilities by using the scheme and in the scheme. But you know, whenever I brought up rural and remote, everyone just sort of stood back, and there was sort of this look on people's faces like, oh, okay, you know, that's your baby. You know, we don't want to get involved because we don't know about it. It wasn't like people wanted to exclude rural and remote, but they just didn't understand, or just thought, oh, I don't know enough about that to have an opinion or to want to engage in the conversation. So I think perhaps we're not doing a very good job of PR for rural and remote and how we can engage. And we saw during the pandemic that people...
I was just about to say, it became even differently obvious, didn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. The buy from the bush stuff, you know, there is a great connection there. And, you know, we need city and we need country. And I think perhaps it's just more of a conversation that needs to happen between city and country about... The good things that we can offer.
So nowadays you are working with Sarah on the board and in the executive team. Before we talk about your role there, I just want to give you an open mic and as much time as you want to tell us about what Sarah does. I'm a huge fan and have followed their work for years, but I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people listening weren't across this stuff yet.
Yeah. So I call it Sarah. Some people call it Sarah, but there are two schools of thought. It's sort of like two fighting factions. But just so you know,
that's so funny.
It's a constant discussion within the membership. So yeah, it stands for Services for Australian Rural and Remote Allied Health. And we exist to advocate for the health and well-being and sustainability of people in rural and remote areas of Australia through the support that Allied Health gives. And we do that primarily at the moment through developing the Rural Generalist Program. So some people may have heard about the Medical Rural Generalist Program, where doctors are trained in a broad variety of skills to be able to support people with diverse needs in a small community, in a rural or a remote area. And it's a similar concept with Allied Health. So, and I should clarify that the generalist nature of a clinician is not sort of a generalist allied health professional, because that's something that some people misinterpret. It's a generalist within your discipline. So me being a speech pathologist, if I were to practice as a rural generalist, which I have done, then I would perhaps be in the morning going to an aged care facility, in the afternoon going to a preschool, helping out at the local hospital, doing NDIS work, being able to work across a range of different areas, being able to collaborate and build partnerships across those services. And the Rural Generalist Program helps someone to be able to set up a job like that in their clinic, or to help an NGO plan service delivery models, which will help to employ people like that or attract new people who want to train as rural generalists. And the strength of that is that you don't get this situation where, say, a community gets really excited that they've never had a physio in town. They employ a physio at the local hospital, and then everyone gets really excited because, granny down at the aged care facility really needs help getting mobile, kids down at the preschool. There's some kids with disabilities there who want to learn how to ride a bike, and everyone thinks, great, the physio's in town, they can help with all this. But they work at the hospital, so they're only allowed to work at the hospital and only allowed to work with inpatients. But when we set up rural generalist roles in communities, then we can actually work across all of those contexts and set up clinical governance structures within those NGOs or within those clinics, which support really good evidence-based practice across a range of different clinical areas. So I'm really excited about the Rural Generalist Program. I think it's about $9 million that we've got from the Department of Health over 3 years to implement this program. And it also includes developing some allied health assistant positions. So the listeners would appreciate that there's just not enough allied health professionals. And in a small town, you can't always have, in a town of 3,000, you're not always going to have a physiotherapist, an occupational therapist, a psychologist, a speech pathologist, a podiatrist, a dietitian. But if you have an allied health assistant, and if you have people, clinicians who can be there sometimes, supporting, training, delegating to the allied health assistant, then you can build sustainable services in smaller communities. You can reduce people's need to leave home to get support, either temporarily or permanently. You can save money on travel. You can save money on accommodation. Broadly speaking, that's what the Rural Generalist Program is, and that's a core piece of work that Sarah does. We also work on advocating for better workforce training pipelines, better workforce distribution across Australia, and we do that through lobbying and regular meetings with people like the Chief Allied Health Officer. Fantastic that we have a Chief Allied Health Officer now, and the National Rural Health Commissioner, and as well as sort of working with the Department of Health and Department of Social Services very closely. So we regularly sort of meet with these people to push forward the agenda of our members, who are the people who are seeing this stuff happening on the ground and who are solving problems on the ground as well.
If listeners are really curious about the Rural Generalist Program, they can get in touch with you, but then what does that collaboration and that program look like from their point of view?
Yeah, so the training involves postgrad certificate at level 2, and so there's a couple of different levels of the program. I'm not as familiar with level 1 because I don't work as closely with level 1, but I know that level 2 is postgrad cert, where you will study through James Cook University to get skills in rural generalism. We also work with the service that sort of holds holds that money for the rural generalist position. So the money's held through whatever company it is. It might be a private practice, it might be an NGO. So they work with us to develop a service delivery model that's going to work for that particular rural generalist. So what are the service needs in that particular community? What do they need to do to prioritise their caseload? What do they need to do in terms of upskilling that generalist in a particular area? Is there more aged care stuff? Is there more disability stuff? Is there more community health stuff? And so we work through sort of clinical governance elements with the provider, with the company, and then the rural generalist trainee will access regular training through that university course.
Mm. Are there graduates of the uni course out and about working already?
Yeah, there are. I couldn't give you numbers, but there are. We know that the course has been run outside of Sarah for a while now, and it's in state health services. It started in Queensland, and has seen pretty good levels of success in sort of public contexts. We're still testing it out in sort of private and NGO areas to see how the model works. It's really, I think one of the challenges with a training program like this is in, say, sort of an NDIS context, you're looking at billable hours. So you need to make time for that person to train, to get the skills to be able to support people really well with really good evidence-based therapies. But a lot of the time, a company might have a sort of a short-term focus, and they can't necessarily see the benefit of investing in that person in the short term to be able to then get some really good services, get better sort of job retention down the track through having trained them as a rural generalist. And we know that rural generalist training can help retain staff, which is really important in rural and remote areas. Even if you've got someone for a couple of years in a remote area, you're doing well. Mm. So that's the big challenge that we face, is sort of that how can we make that more palatable, that we are providing this training? How can we make that focus a little bit more long term for the providers and the NGOs, the private practices?
I guess it's building in sustainability, isn't it? Because you've got a sizable investment and strong partnerships with JCU and the like, and you're wanting to see this stay in the marketplace and be something people look forward to being able to train up in and live and work in their environments and support their communities.
Mm. Yeah, and really, pragmatically speaking, we want to show that it works at scale, and we want to then show that to the department so that they continue to fund that more widely across Australia, because that's what's going to keep more people in the bush working and supporting rural communities.
Can you explain to us a little bit more about the AHAs and the training and supports that are available for those wonderful people? This is a cohort in the industry that I'm most excited and curious about. It's just such an interesting career pathway for people, and it's feeling a little loose currently, but I understand that it's being strengthened up.
Yeah, so we provide either Cert 3 or Cert 4 training through the Rural Generalist Program. I'm not sure about the exact nature of the training that they have, but that's an accredited TAFE course that they do at the certificate level. I know there's been a lot of concern about sort of clinical safety, clinical governance with allied health assistants. I don't see the big issue, to be honest. I think there's potentially some clinical contexts in which there's warranted caution, but in many contexts, there, you know, we're doing stuff that couldn't possibly do any harm. If you got a little bit wrong, you show them the wrong picture card, it's not the end of the world. But I think that in talking about this, I usually like to talk about how we work with families, because clinicians work with families all the time. You know, if you're working with kids, you're working with families, you're working with parents, and you're training parents in therapy. And you're trusting the
classroom assistants and anybody else.
Exactly.
Gather around, dear listeners, for a moment of sheer audio delight. You may have heard, but we love to chat with allied health business owners. We get inspired hearing about your aspirations, the challenges you face, the roadblocks that get in your way, and business realities. So we invite you to book a free power call with a Naker Consulting business specialist, regardless of where you're at in business. Maybe you're feeling overwhelmed or overworked or overjoyed. We're here for you, and we'll meet you exactly where you are, judgment-free. It's okay to book a second or even a third call. We're always keen to hear all your news. Book a free power call with us today at naker.com.au/free-power-call. Let's get the convo ball rolling. Now it's time to get back to our regularly scheduled banter.
Running a business isn't just about setting up shop and becoming complacent. It's about showing up for ourselves and our clients with a commitment to continuous improvement. We have to be honest with ourselves about where we're at and where we're going. That means identifying strengths and weaknesses so we can improve. After all, if we're remaining stagnant, how can we scale and build the business and life of our dreams? That's where the NACAR Consulting Allied Health Biz Quiz comes in. We're not talking horoscopes and horoscopia. This questionnaire is the perfect starting point for you to begin identifying your strengths, needs, and blind spots as an allied health business owner. The process is simple. Answer the 14 questions and we'll send you a personalized report that includes actionable steps for you to start taking your business to the next level. Ready to take your business into your own hands? Take the NACAR Consulting Allied Health Biz Quiz today.
So when you're working with an allied health assistant, you're actually working with someone who's more highly trained than those people. And they're an expert in community as well, which cannot be
understated.
Mm. Yep. So in the PhD research that I did, that was one of the key findings, was that if we want to be able to build sustainable telehealth models, then we need to forget about technology. We need to think about how we build connections in community. Yeah. And you do that with a coworker or an allied health assistant, whatever.
Someone on site. Yeah.
Yeah. Because the clinician has the clinical knowledge, but they don't have the knowledge of community and family. But that allied health assistant in community does. That's what they have. So the two sides of the same coin, your clinician and your allied health assistant. Who can then make a more productive relationship. And really when it comes down to it, I think we're just a little bit protective. I know in speech pathology, very protective of our
turf. It's the turf.
Yeah. So I mean, I'm happy to share with people about how I try to support people's communication or meal times. I think that's a great thing.
Yeah.
And I think we can do it well, and the literature says we can do it well with allied health assistants. So.
And my position on it when I work clinically is I only know a certain bit of it anyways. I can only bring the best bits that I know that feel most relevant and best supported, but I'm not really the expert. I'm not. Yeah, they're day in, day out. There's lots of other perspectives to consider to bring in, and I think collaboration with the right guardrails, what beats that? Mm.
That's an interesting point, yeah. In some of my PhD case studies, when I was talking with people about sort of the possibility of, you know, sort of a generalist rural clinician versus getting support from someone who's really specialized in a particular area from a metro area, you know, getting a support or advice from them, whether through telehealth or FIFO or whatever it is. What they said was basically, it doesn't need to be perfect. It doesn't need to be specialized. We just want a bit of help. So even if the generalist, you know, isn't super expert in that particular therapy or can't do that particular therapy because they're not licensed to, or they don't, you know, they haven't worked in that area enough, families are really happy just to get a bit of support. I don't know that that's what we should aim for necessarily.
And it doesn't mean you can't have a bit of both. You know, you can get in and get started and then bring in a different opinion at some point.
I think so, yeah. And I'd love to see something like the Medicare model. Sorry, my dog's snoring in the background.
That's okay. I just crashed my pen on the desk. I think we'll just keep it real.
Boston says hello. I think we should have something like Medicare where, you know, you go to the GP and the GP says, oh, I can't help you with that. I'm going to refer you to the neurologist. But Medicare will pay for the neurologist and the GP to have a telehealth consult. You're there with the GP. I reckon we should do that with Allied Health.
More roundtable collaboration.
Yeah. The generalist clinician in the bush. Sits in town and on video with you know, the specialist assistive technology person, you know, in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, and NDIS pays for it. NDIS,
you're not asking for much there, Ed. You're just asking for a bit of common sense.
Yeah. Sorry. I better wake up to myself.
I know that, that just saves everybody so much time and mixed messaging and could cut to the chase, I suspect.
Yeah.
Tell us a little more about what else, Sarah, I don't know what to call it now. What else are you guys working on?
So the Allied Health Rural Generalist training program is the big thing. We also have a conference coming up. It's an online conference on the 15th and 16th of November. So
2022. Yep.
Yeah, this year. So only 4 short weeks away. And the theme is people, purpose, passion, pathways to success. So
you pleased with the program?
I'm talking there, so most of it. Well,
that's going to be
necessarily
good.
That part. it's going to be great. There's some, I think there's a good mix of sort of your researchy stuff and your QI projects and your stories from the field. We like to keep it pretty real at Sarah. We know that the realities are that the sort of literature that we read, the sort of training that we have, the case studies we see at uni and in the literature don't really work for us usually. There's so many other considerations that we have that go into stuff. So hearing real stories from people who are working in the bush and, you know, even if they're horror stories and, you know, you don't get any sort of solution from it.
There's learnings attached.
Yeah. Everyone just kind of sits there and listens and goes, yep, I've been there. Sarah conferences, really fun events. This year it's online. So we're fully online and you can come from anywhere. Regardless of postcode, you just need an internet connection to be able to join us, and you don't need to be from the bush. You don't need to work rurally. You just anyone who's interested in what it means to see practice in rural and remote areas, then I'd encourage you to come along. It'll be a very good time.
Is it a day or 2 days?
2 days on the 15th and 16th.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Yeah. The other wonderful thing, and we were talking about this before I hit record, is the newsletter you guys send out.
Yeah.
It's been my number one favorite newsletter for many years, and I did confess that I seem to have disappeared off it, or it's disappeared out of my system, so I'm going to go and chase that up this afternoon. But the commentary that you guys provide and the position and representation is amazing, but this newsletter has always been such a good roundup of what's going on in the bush, but also what's going on more generally across the sector. So kudos to the author or authors.
Kath Maloney, our CEO, usually is the main person behind Connected, our weekly newsletter, and go to our website to sign up to it. It is a great read. And she's very proud of it. She works hard on it because everyone named Kath or Kathy is really passionate about what they do.
There you go.
Kath's really passionate about what she does. She's really passionate about rural and remote Australia. Everyone is at Sarah. That really shows, I think, in everything we do. We're a really close-knit team. And so I think that shows up in the newsletter where we're talking real stuff. We're talking about, you know, what is the government doing to support rural and remote people? Where is the NDIS going in the next 10 years?
I want to read that one.
Yeah. So really, really important stuff about what it means in terms of real stuff on the ground, what that means for our communities. Our policy director, Alan Groth, is also heavily involved in writing the newsletter, and he's a policy guru. He's a genius. Mm. He knows how bureaucracy works. I've been on the board for about 6 years now. Been working very closely with federal and state government and ministers and all that kind of thing, and I still have no idea how they communicate, what they're saying, and, you know, what the subtext is to all of the communications. But Alan's like an interpreter, so he can tell me exactly what something means when a minister says something or when a bureaucrat says something, which is really useful, actually.
Interpretation. Mm. Can I ask you, where do you think the NDIS is going in the next 10 years? You can take a pause and chill the Chardonnay.
Yeah. Getting on to the easy questions now, Kathy.
Well, who knows? Who knows?
Where is the NDIS going? I think the biggest thing that we can change with the NDIS is our attitude towards the letter I in the NDIS. It's an insurance scheme, and I don't think I've heard anyone say that, you know, well, I don't know if I can say I'm a fan of Bill Shorten on a public podcast, but yeah, I am. I do like Bill Shorten. I do like the way he's approaching his ministry now. He's in talking with him. He understands what rural and remote is, and he understands what allied health is, and he understands that we are a big part of a successful NDIS, and a successful NDIS means strong communities and inclusion for everyone. So I'm really heartened by that.
Yeah.
But I want the government to talk about insurance more. I want them to talk about the fact that this is not an expense. There is no cost blowout in the NDIS. There is there's a profit blowout if we put more money into it, because people are then able to work more. They're able to get a job. They're able to get an education. They're able to participate in communities. Yeah, exactly. It's a no-brainer for mine. So change the rhetoric around the letter I in NDIS. If we can do that in the next 10 years, I think that would be fantastic. More practically speaking, I think we're maybe, I'm not sure if we will see it, but what we should see is a change in the way we train allied health at university. I did one disability subject when I studied at university, and I basically just learned about primitive reflexes and a little bit about cerebral palsy and Down syndrome, which was completely useless.
As though it hasn't changed since I did it in the 80s. Possibly it hasn't.
Yes.
So they might have added genetics, maybe.
we train people to work in hospitals. We train people in the medical model. Community health. But now one of the, if not the largest publicly funded source of public funding for allied health is coming through the NDIS for people with disabilities. We are not training people for the NDIS. We are not training people for the future of allied health and the future of our communities in Australia.
I agree.
The public policy that we have in place.
Oh, you're getting a round of applause from listeners, Ed. People have pulled over and so true. This is such a concern, along with a frustration for business owners and people bringing early career clinicians into their crew. It's really
a chicken and egg problem, though. It's a chicken and egg problem because we don't have the academics working in disability to then say to universities, "Hey, we need more of this stuff." I don't know that we have the capability just yet in some of the disciplines to be able to accredit a course like that. Do our professional peak bodies allow for more disability subjects? Because, you know, it's maybe at the expense of learning XYZ, which is, you know, traditionally part of accrediting an OT, a physio, a speech pathologist. So there's some thinking that needs to go into that.
Do you wait till it's perfect and signed off, or can you kind of get started?
I want to get started, but I'm a pragmatist.
What rules?
You know, yeah.
Surely people.
Ask for forgiveness, yeah. I'm a big fan of just getting started and doing it. I have a role at Western Sydney Uni as a lecturer in speech pathology, and take every opportunity I can to talk about NDIS, to talk about disability, to talk about the realities of clinical practice, to talk about rural and remote, because that is what I've seen. That's the realities of what I've seen. I haven't seen the really polished case studies of middle class kids who have one identifiable issue and, you know, they're going to be fine after six therapy sessions. I've never seen that. You know, I've seen the tricky stuff. So that's what I want to teach about, and that's the stuff that I find meaningful to work with communities about as well.
I wonder what undergrad allied health assistance professionals would say if they could kind of join in now and sort of say, "Help, yes, please get me ready for the workforce." And I'd love to hear their voice in this, because I wonder if it does create tension for them that if they want to work with children and families, it is going to be largely NDIS. And what does that mean? And how does my clinical practice fit into that context? I don't feel prepared for this. And some of my colleagues run various courses for, perhaps therapists wanting to swap and work with kids and families. I don't like calling it pediatrics, so I'm trying to find all the words around that, because it just shrieks to that medical model. But what they're reporting is more and more undergraduates are booking tickets and booking places on these 2 and 3 day courses. Because they kind of want something. They want some conceptual understanding, some vocab, some confidence around it, so that when they're out selecting where they're going to work in their first job, that they've got something to bring.
I think that's great. I think that should be part of the university course, though. That's the goal in the future, perhaps. I wouldn't want to talk for all these people studying, and you know, the future of the professions in therapy assistants and clinicians. I get the sense that they're easily influenced by what they see sort of in
either Facebook groups.
In Facebook groups, yeah. in placements, in their first job out, they just, you know, they're sponges. They soak up whatever we sort of give them, and if we're giving them this sense of you know, it's okay to practice with complex disability even if you don't know what you're doing, then that's not the right thing, I don't think. But at the same time, we can't just say, oh well, we have a huge multi-billion dollar scheme in Australia now, of which a large chunk of that money is for allied health to support people with disabilities, and say, oh no, actually we don't have the workforce to do that because we're not trained. You know, you can count all these allied health professionals as allied health professionals, but have they ever worked in disability? Probably not, until they heard about the NDIS. That's tricky. That's what I struggle with on a daily basis. I think, well, should this person be working with a person with disability?
Yeah.
Effectively, probably not. But are they going to get anything otherwise? It's sort of that beneficence and non-maleficence sort of quagmire that you get into, ethically speaking.
And then layer on the context that you work in of rural and remote as well.
Yeah, absolutely, because you don't get a choice usually. There might be no allied health professional, or there might be one. NDIS comes to town and they say there's this market-based system. Well, no, it's not. It's just
not. No, you know, it's got a little way to go there. Oh, goodness, goodness, goodness. Is there anything else about Sarah that you'd like people to know?
It's free to join for students.
Okay. That was a good segue.
Cool. If you are a student, or if you know students, encourage them to join. That would be fantastic. Get discounted rates to our conference. And I hope you're all going to come to the conference.
Yeah, we might. We'll do our best to bump up production and get this episode out before the conference.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll see what we can do.
That would be great. I suppose those are the main things. I mean, we want to be able to spend more time on advocacy. We want to be able to be at the table whenever decisions are being made about allied health policy, and we generally are. But I think because we are a small outfit, we represent rural and remote, our voice gets lost sometimes. So opportunities like this to talk about Sarah and to spread the word is really good. So I think if you sort of getting back to our chat at the start about, you know, the connection between city and country, I think even if you aren't from the bush, never intend on going to the bush. I mean, you
hard to miss in Australia.
You know, that's where your food comes from. That's where all the produce comes from. That's where a lot of the manufacturing happens. You know, we are connected, and you need us. So follow us on social media.
Totally. We'll give all of those links. All of those links.
Yeah.
Ed, so good to catch up. Thank you so much for coming in and, sharing what you're up to now, and throwing a whole lot more light on Sarah and the Rural Generalist Program and what you guys are focusing on.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks, Kathy. It's been nice to be here.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. For the show notes and other resources, our webinar replays, they're all available over on naker.com.au.
And if you're loving what you're listening to, please subscribe. We don't want you to miss out on a single thing. And if you want others to get the same benefit that you've had from listening into these episodes, please share this episode and any of the others forward to any of your other allied health business colleagues. And we are totally here for you. Don't forget for a moment that you can jump on in and book that power call, and we can see how we can help you get the best of business done. Looking forward to seeing you there.